diseases are inherited is not new. Diseases such as this, which is a pedigree of muscular dystrophy, circles, girls, squares, men, and the ones blacked in are individuals affected with the disorder in question. So that's a pedigree showing multiple affected individuals with the same disease within a family, and that sort of thing for many diseases has been known since biblical times. Absolutely nothing new about it at all. And because those really strictly inherited diseases are relatively uncommon, I brought this slightly more complicated version of some slightly more common diseases: rheumatoid arthritis, schizophrenia, and the others that you can mention there. And what this chart, what this chart shows is twin concordance. So people have studied sets of twins, identical twins in the sickly green, and non-identical twins in the slightly less sickly bluish colour, and have asked the question, if twin A has the disease, does twin B have the same disease? And the message that comes from that, for these fairly common disorders, not thought of as inherited disorders, is at least three. Firstly, that in all cases, the identical twins are much more likely to share the disease than the non-identical twins. And since the difference between those two is predominantly that the identical twins, of course, have identical genes, you can infer that genes have something to do with these diseases. Secondly, even the non-identical twins share diseases much more often than you would expect by chance. Same sort of message. Thirdly, that even, and probably most importantly, even with identical genes, absolute clones of one another, and born at the same time to the same mother and usually brought up together, so very similar environmental components to their upbringing, the likelihood that they would share the same disease still hovers around the 50% mark, goes up a bit above that. So that tells you quite plainly, A, genes are important, B, genes are not the whole story. Those are two really important messages to keep in line, and this is taken from a textbook that, although published in 1994, was quoting data that comes from the 70s and 80s. Nothing new. I should pause and say that these actual levels are almost certainly maximum estimates. They're inflated. They're higher than they should be as estimates of the genetic contribution to disease for all sorts of reasons, both common sense and technical. They're selected populations. They do have substantial environmental commonality. So the actual numbers are probably too high, but the messages, I think, are very clear and not new. Until 20 years ago, a gene was a concept. There was no such thing as a gene in reality that anyone could get their fingers on. A gene was a concept. So we knew there was a gene for haemophilia because certain people, when they cut themselves, went on bleeding. So there was something wrong with them, which we knew was inherited, which fouled up their blood clotting. But we didn't know what that something was in any concrete sense. Over the last 20 years, the techniques that have developed for getting bits of human DNA, the bits that you want, identifying them, identifying their sequence, and tying them to a function has reified the gene. It's no longer just an inductive concept. It's now a real piece of DNA sequence. So many of the genes that make us what we are have now been specifically identified. We know exactly where they are and what they are. This process of finding genes is boring and tedious in the extreme. For many genes, even unto today, there's a group who work very close to where I am in Cambridge, although not of my department, who have recently, as part of an international consortium of half a dozen very good lads, managed to clone a gene, a simply inherited disorder gene, which they've been chasing for 5 years. It really is awful. Contrast that with the experience of another colleague of mine in Italy who recently told a story of a family that they came across, two large-ish families, with an inherited form of spasticity. They did some pretty crude gene mapping, decided it was probably somewhere around the bottom of that chromosome, went to a computer, happened to light upon a part of the human genome for which a lot of sequence data was already on public databases. Within a fortnight, they tied it all up and was on its way to the publishers. Finding genes is greatly speeded up if you have got the gene sequenced for you there to look at. So, that is the rationale for the Human Genome Project. A number of large laboratories have been engaged on this for about, what, 7-8 years now, for, you know, hard engaged, most intensely over the past 2 or 3 years. And they are not looking for disease genes, they are simply saying, let us sequence all the DNA from beginning to end, put the whole menu out there, all the genes will be there, and people can find them by sitting at a desk on a computer rather than by grubbing around in test tubes, a much more efficient process. And that is the Human Genome Project. And that is roughly how far they have got as of about a month and a half ago. Of the 3,000 million bases, is that right? No, yep, that is right. That there is per cell in a human, about half is actually on, or was on, publicly accessible websites at that time. And that's going up very rapidly. It'll be two-thirds in a month or two, and it'll be up the top there by the autumn or thereabouts on the public side. And a much smaller proportion of that has been what we call finished. That is, this stuff is just bits of sequence chucked out there with some idea of where they come from. This is tidied up, all the holes filled in, all the bits got together, the gaps filled in so that it's continuous sequence in a comprehensive form. There is also a much publicized private venture, one particular company, doing much the same thing in parallel, and they have approximately the same amount of sequence that they have generated themselves, but that's not accessible, so it's at the moment a bit harder to know precisely how that'll fit in. Between the two of these, for practical purposes, a rough draft full of thousands of holes and gaps and inaccuracies will be out sometime by the middle of this year at the latest, and a process after that of finishing it all off will take another couple of years. So that's essentially behind us. That's the Human Genome Project. What's it good for? Well, the one thing is it's good for finding diseases which are caused by single genes, but that's almost done. So the big question is this really going to help us understand complex diseases, diabetes and hypertension and so forth? And the answer is probably yes, but probably yes. The reason that these diseases are called complex diseases is because they're complex. They are not inherited in a simple way. And I have this noddy pedigree to help you perhaps understand my view of why. So these two individuals have the same disorder. They are related to one another, but that isn't a real pedigree. There are only two of them amongst a large number of family members, none of the rest of them affected. If you could look at the genes that are relevant, of course, genes don't do that kind of thing. Genes are either there or they're not. So everyone with a dot has got the gene, but only these two show the disease. The dissociation between having gene variants and getting disease is what makes complex diseases complex. You do not have this relationship of gene mistake leads to clinical picture. It's more complicated. Why is it more complicated? Well, you know, who knows? It's more complicated. But there are only two formal possibilities. One is other genes also have an effect. Second is environmental factors are needed in order to bring out the disorder. Both are almost certainly true in almost all of these cases. When you try to find these genes, however, you're faced with the fact that you can't do simple gene-disease correlations, because some people with the gene that you're studying won't have the disease, and other people with what looks like the same disease won't have the gene because they've got the same sort of presentation but by a different mechanism. Some other gene has led them down the same path. breast cancer, which you mentioned earlier and Mark Stratton's worked on, is a good example that we know that several different genes lead to what looks pretty much to the eye like the same breast cancer, and most cases of breast cancer which look pretty much the same don't have anything to do with those two genes. Breast cancer is a high-level phenotype, and you can get there by lots of different routes. So this lack of correlation makes finding these things difficult. And I think the truth is that at the moment, as we stand today, there are very few examples of genes contributing to these complex diseases that have really been nailed down. It's not as easy as people make it out to be. My personal opinion, others will come in later. Put slightly differently, because I'm going to come on to testing in a moment as my last point, if you look at the predictive power of a genetic test and imagine it this way, that you are given a sample of blood and you know nothing about the individual concerned, you do a particular genetic test and you find a particular gene abnormality, what's the likelihood that the person with that gene change has actually got the disease that you started out thinking about? And it's effectively, it's called penetrance in genetic terms, and predictive power is a straightforward enough term. For muscular dystrophy, which is one of these simply inherited things, it's virtually 100%. If you've got the characteristic gene change, you either have or soon will have the disease. For Huntington's, which is much spoken of, it's below 100%. The breast cancer genes, 80%. This is an old slide. That's an overestimate. And down at the other end here, for one of the first of these sort of genes that contribute to complex diseases that was nailed down recently, and that's quite a big one, the chance that the person with the gene change actually has insulin-dependent diabetes is around 1 in 200. Now, that's massively increased above population level. But as a matter of practical use to the carrier, to tell someone you have got a 1 in 200 chance of getting this disease is frankly of no use whatsoever unless you can do something about it. To remind myself, to remind you, despite lots and lots to the contrary in the public discussion, modern genetics has not discovered that more diseases are genetic, just isn't so. We've known that for ages. What we're doing is finding tools for grubbing away at them. Secondly, in no way does the current technology for looking at genes diminish the importance of the environmental contribution to these diseases. Our information on the relative importance of genetics and environment has not changed as a result of the genetic revolution. What has changed is our ability to specify, we think, which genes are involved. That's really an important distinction. So, what is the purpose of the Human Genome Project? What will it deliver? How am I doing? Still a minute. I'm finishing. So, and I've put these in this order. I think the first thing is this is seriously going to change human biology and medicine. I don't think that's contentious. But the major effect is that by finding genes and genes which are associated with particular functions, normal or abnormal, we effectively are opening up a new way of understanding human biochemistry, because genes are the recipes for the chemicals that make our physical bodies what they are. And if you know the recipes, if you understand what these molecules are, you can begin to get to grips with how the whole system functions in a way which is orders of magnitude more powerful than anything that's gone before. And that changes biochemistry, it changes physiology, it changes electrophysiology, it changes evolutionary studies, of course it has already changed forensics, it changes all of biology, not only human, but all of biology. That is seriously important. If one understands processes, the chances of being able to develop rational treatments, well, if it isn't true that understanding something improves your chances of developing a rational treatment, I should be awfully sorry, because most of science is then just philosophically fouled up, and I don't believe that's the case. It doesn't mean you'll always find some way of curing, but it does mean in general you will. But mostly, my guess is, that's going to be the pharmaceutical industry doing what it does best, which is understanding pharmacology and making pills, injections, or vaccinations. We will get better diagnostics. We have them already for rare disorders, in the sense that we no longer have to guess. To take an arcane example, there are about a dozen different kinds of limb-girdle muscular dystrophy. Clinicians have argued for decades as to whether it's this one or that one. You now do a test and it says it's type A or it's type B. The same will apply to diabetes and breast cancer in the rest. We will have much finer categories, and they will actually be defined by specific test patterns. So that's good, because it enables you to tailor your treatment to the right disease rather than just to a broad category of things, all of which give you a high blood sugar, but which may actually have quite different etiological roots. You will also undoubtedly within there find that some people respond better to some drugs than to others, and there is a whole burgeoning area of what is called pharmacogenetics, the concept of tailoring medicines to people and their metabolism, which is all entirely rational, but from which there are as yet very few practical products. And right at the end, I think there will be some situations in which testing leads to long-range accurate disease prediction. But my guess is not many. The story that we will go in 10 years' time to our GP surgery, put a drop of blood on a slide, he puts it in a machine, it's read on a microchip, and he says, well, you know, myocardial infarction at the age of 42, sorry old chap, is science fiction. It is extremely unlikely, in my view, for the reasons that I sort of alluded to before, that that level of accurate prediction will ever come to pass. Will come to pass in many situations. There will be different situations, of course. There are an infinite number of disorders and an infinite number of permutations of genes. There will be situations in which long-range prediction will come about, but they will not be common. I'll leave you with one example of that, which is entirely informal, unpublished, and came from a bit of browbeating on a friend of mine in Cambridge called Paul Farrow, who also works on breast cancer. He's an epidemiologist. So I asked him if he could work out for me how likely it was that if one got rid from the breast cancer pool of those few cases, those few percent that are caused by single genes of large effect, what's the sort of maximum level of prediction that you might get for the rest, I asked him. And he beavered away for a while, and it's essentially unanswerable. But he came up with, I thought, quite an interesting statistic in the end. Having got rid of those few percent, about 75% of the remaining breast cancers occur in about 50% of the population. Not currently identifiable, but you could more or less work that out. Now, that's quite interesting. It says that you have got a concentration of risk within a subgroup of the population, but it does not suggest that you're going to be able to pick out 10 or 15% and say, well, the rest of you lot are okay, you are the people at risk. It's very unlikely to come that way. That's a slightly sour note on which to end, but given that I know that Mike Stratton is going to be terribly upbeat, I thought that that would probably be a fair introduction. Thank you very much.